In spring, we are working our way through the Gospel of Mark. We are nearing the middle of this book where Jesus will ask Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" And we've talked about how for any reader of this Gospel, and really anyone who seriously considers Christianity, that they too must come to grips with this question. We've learned a great deal about Jesus in these past few weeks. And we've seen him do a number of things, all things that might help us to respond to that question, "Who do you say that I am?" We've seen him be baptized and announce that the kingdom of God has come near. We've seen him call some followers, now 12 close followers, who became known as apostles, those sent out by Jesus to participate in his mission. We've seen him heal the sick and cast out demons as first fruits of this kingdom. We've seen him heal a paralytic and forgive his sins, something that only God can do. We've seen him draw a crowd of followers, even beyond those 12 apostles, and we've seen him initiate conflict with the scribes and Pharisees, a conflict that has started to grow and grow. By now we're getting the picture that Jesus might be more than we bargained for. We're getting the picture that Jesus is not necessarily the most comfortable guy to be around. If we're thinking of following him ourselves, we're getting the picture that it might involve conflict for us, too. We've been in the boat with the apostles during a terrible storm, and we've seen Jesus' power to calm the wind and the sea, calming it by commanding it to be still. And we talked last week about how on the cross, Jesus calms the storm of sin, a storm that separates us from God, the only storm that can really kill us. Today, we will see him heal a woman, which we've seen him do before, and raise a 12-year-old girl from the dead, which we have not seen. That's something new. And these are both very important, but if we're not careful, we'll miss what Jesus is really doing here. Let us listen for the word of the Lord as it comes to us in Mark's Gospel in chapter 5, verses 21 through 43. This will be found on page 915 of the Church Bibles. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you? How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it, but the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha kum, which means little girl, get up. And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. If you've been around the church for very long, you will probably recognize that part of the tension in this passage has to do with the ritual purity laws that the Israelites followed. The Old Testament book of Leviticus details these laws. One of them that is relevant to the passage this morning comes from Leviticus 15. Now stay with me, we're not going to be in Leviticus all morning. It says, if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanness. Every bed on which she lies, everything on which she sits shall be unclean. And whoever touches these things shall be unclean. Thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, so that they do not die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle. These and other similar laws sound quite extreme to us 3,000 or 4,000 years later, and many of them are often held up in a mocking way. We might think to ourselves, boy, I'm really glad that we've progressed on and don't have to deal with that kind of nonsense today. But before we get too self-righteous, it might benefit us to realize that we have our own kinds of purity codes today. If you don't believe me, I would encourage you to spend some time in an airport or a bus station and see who sits by whom, who avoids whom, what happens when somebody out of the norm comes along. If you can't make it to a bus station or an airport, you can try your local school cafeteria. And it's not just those people who seem a bit odd to us. Think about it as something as common as when somebody has a cold. They try to touch nobody, and everybody tries to avoid touching them. It doesn't take superhuman powers of observation to realize that our culture has its own notions of clean and unclean and enforces them with no less vigor. That might help us to look beyond what seems really odd to us and see what's really going on in this passage. So the reading begins with a man named Jairus coming to Jesus and falling at his feet. Jairus is described as one of the leaders of the synagogue, and he begs and begs for Jesus to come to his house and to heal his sick daughter, his 12-year-old who is at the point of death. So Jesus agrees, and they're on their way. Now, it's probably easy for us to recognize that as a synagogue leader, he would probably have a bit of an elite status in the society in the town there, which is probably Capernaum. And so in seeing him cast himself down at Jesus' feet, we're probably struck by the depth of his faith, or at least the depth of his concern for his daughter's health. He's desperate for her to be healed. Hold that thought, because Jesus gets interrupted on his way to Jairus' house. They encounter a woman. A woman, we're told, had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. It's not hard to imagine how desperate this woman was. The physical ailment would be bad enough, to be sick for so long, to spend all her money on doctors, to feel like she would never be whole again. It had to be distressing. But beyond that, think of what those purity and cleanness regulations mean for someone in her condition. She would not be able to share meals with anyone. Everyone would be afraid of getting too close to her. She would not be able to worship in the synagogue. She would feel utterly removed from the presence of God. It'd be horrifically alienating. She would begin to feel like a non-person. And after 12 years, what hope would she have? She's desperate. But she's heard about this Jesus, and she clings to a hope that he might be able to heal her. Realize what a big risk she is taking by getting into this crowd to see Jesus. Anyone who touched her would be made unclean as well. One writer describes this woman as positively radioactive in her ability to spread ritual contamination. But somehow, she gets close enough to touch his clothes, the hem of his garment, as Sam Cooke sings. Now, imagine what Jairus is thinking. He already has to be distraught by this delay. But also remember the importance of ritual purity, especially for religious leaders. For Jairus to carry out his duties in the synagogue, he has to remain free from contamination. He is desperate for Jesus to come to his home. But for Jesus to enter his house, he would need to be ritually pure in order not to defile the house. If Jesus were somehow unclean, such as if he were touched by a bleeding woman, and he went into Jairus' home, this would hinder Jairus from fulfilling his leadership duties at the synagogue. How could Jesus now tend to the daughter, since to become clean again would require a day-long ritual of cleansing? But look what happens when Jesus talks to her. He simply says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." And then he continues on to Jairus' house. In this simple act of faith, Jesus transforms her life in a way that she can't imagine. He stops her bleeding. He heals her, calls her daughter. When this woman touches Jesus' robe, instead of her contamination polluting Jesus, his purity, his holiness, overcomes her uncleanness. And the source of her impurity is healed. She'll be able to experience things that she hasn't for years. Now, it's not supposed to work this way. One writer compared it to water spontaneously deciding to run uphill. He says a healing divine generosity suddenly infuses the whole scene and turns all the rules upside down. Instead of her contamination being contagious, it is Jesus' purity that is contagious. So no longer is she barred from the presence of God. No longer is she on the outside looking in. This nameless woman has touched the cloak of God himself. Now they continue to the synagogue official's house, although perhaps nobody but Jesus knows why. The little girl has died. They're too late. There is another background issue from the Old Testament that we need to see here in order to realize the significance of what Jesus does, to see how these two stories tie together. The body of a dead person is also a source of uncleanness. People who come into contact with a corpse also become unclean. Listen to this from the book of Numbers. "Whoever touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days. He shall cleanse himself with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and so be clean. But if he does not cleanse himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not become clean. Whoever touches a dead person, the body of anyone who has died, and does not cleanse himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel." Even more so than the scene with the bleeding woman, contamination, uncleanness, all of that pervades the scene in this 12-year-old's bedroom. Knowing all this background amplifies one little detail of what happens next that we might overlook. Look at verse 41. "He took her by the hand and told her to get up." The first scene, it was Jesus being touched by the woman, and the second time, he touches a dead child. And for a second time, religious impurity comes into physical contact with Jesus. And for a second time, instead of the impurity contaminating Jesus, the source of the contamination gives way to the superior power of Jesus' holiness. The result here is even more dramatic than Jesus' healing of and conversation with the woman. Instead of an unclean corpse that can contaminate Jesus, the corpse is resurrected into a healthy young girl. Who do you say that I am? Not only do you have the power to bring the dead back to life, but your holiness rolls back the sources of religious contamination and defilement. Your holiness defeats those forces that would prevent people from coming to you. So what does all of this mean to us? I think that there is an obvious point and maybe a not so obvious point. The obvious point is that we need to be very careful restricting anyone's path to Jesus. If a stinky, smelly, unclean person shows up here in our midst, our reading this morning would have us focus more on bringing that person to Jesus than protecting the holiness of our assembly. If someone you think is unclean brushes past you, bring them to Jesus. If someone you think is unholy comes into contact with you, bring them to Jesus. But look, I think this is a pretty welcoming church. We can always do better. You know that, and I know that. But I think this is a lesson that we've learned pretty well. So we might have to look at things from another angle to see what else this means. It has to do not only with how the church welcomes outsiders, but also how the church nurtures those already in its midst. Those who may have some other barrier preventing them from touching Christ's garment, from being taken by Christ's hand. A seminary professor of mine, one who significantly influenced this sermon, has told the story of his mother, also a seminary professor, who, as a child, she wanted absolutely nothing to do with the church. She was a tomboy with four older brothers, and leaving the opportunity of a good ball game in order to spend Sunday morning at church seemed like the stupidest idea in the world to her. But week after week, her mother dragged her, kicking and screaming, to services, where she would sit, sullen and dejected, counting the minutes until she could get away from this awful place. Even though there was nothing in her attitude or person that was open to it, those Sunday mornings spent in church planted seeds in her heart that later blossomed into a vibrant faith. Despite her best efforts to stay closed off to all of it, there was something in what the church was offering that took root in her heart, and her whole life was different because of it. What were those seeds? Through the word being preached in that church, through the sacraments being celebrated, through the Sunday school teaching of many faithful teachers, through the tenderness and love shown in potluck dinners and youth group overnighters, through the patience and support of those in the congregation with a mature, loving faith who maybe recognized that they had been at the same place at points in their lives. Through all of that, Jesus somehow took her by the hand and said, "Little girl, get up." What does our passage this morning show us about Jesus? That he would have us rejoice when anyone who is hurting, anyone who is broken, anyone who is resistant, even anyone who is bored, is brought into the presence of the one who has the power to make us whole. Friends, the grace of God in Jesus Christ is powerful. Christ's presence is stronger than any force of impurity or contamination. Christ's power is greater, and his grace is stronger than all the powers of uncleanness or darkness. Thanks be to God.